From Nevada Public Radio, I'm Paul Boger. This is State of Nevada. The Boring Company's Vegas Loop is expanding. The underground network of tunnels meant to ferry passengers about the strip recently was issued its first permit by the city of Las Vegas. They can now begin construction on a new tunnel connecting the loop from the Las Vegas Convention Center to downtown. However, the expansion of the Elon Musk-backed venture comes as the Boring Company faces fresh scrutiny, this time from Nevada lawmakers who have raised concerns about alleged workplace safety and environmental violations. Last week, lawmakers spent hours grilling state safety officials over alleged violations by the company. However, company officials declined to attend but provided written answers defending the project. Una Milliken covered the hearing for the Nevada Independent, and she joins us now. Una, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Let's talk about why this hearing was called in the first place. Last year, a couple of stories came out that detailed numerous safety and environmental complaints since construction began in 2019. However, it seems like there were a few notable incidents. What were they?
Well, there's a couple things that have happened. There's been, in 2024, there were two firefighters that experienced chemical burns from like a toxic sludge muck that are in the tunnels. That came out later last year. And then most recently, in August, and this came out a bit later as well, there was like a pool of green water that was questioned, and there was an anonymous complaint about the water, and it turned out to be drill fluid that had been illegally dumped. So those kind of are two of the citations. But then also there was, you know, a meeting with the governor and the president of Boring, as well as the former OSHA director, that was kind of modified. There was a document chronicling the meeting, and then that was modified, so it disappeared. And then there's been like 800 violations from Boring in general that were that have been covered. So there's like a lot of stuff, but those are the main incidents.
All right, let's talk about this hearing last week. Lawmakers grilled state environmental and health and safety regulators for hours. What do lawmakers want to know?
I think the main thing that lawmakers wanted to know, I mean, apart from the fact that they were wondering where Boring was and where the governor's office was, they want to know like why these violations keep happening and why there hasn't been an end to continuous violations. I think the other big question that a lot of people were really curious about is this meeting with Governor Joe Lombardo and Steve Davis, the Boring Co. President, as well as the OSHA director. Like, why was that meeting held? Why were violations kind of dismissed? And there was obviously, why was there a document that was modified to hide the fact that a meeting had been held? So that's what lawmakers were really curious about.
In lieu of showing up to the legislative hearing, the Boring Company did submit a 7-page letter meant to answer some of the lawmakers' questions. You know, what was in that letter?
Well, actually, that letter has not been made public. They talk about it a little bit in the hearing, but it kind of, lawmakers have said that it raised more questions than it answered. As far as, you know, the governor's office, they sent a letter last week also kind of declining to appear and declining to speak, where they said that they had minimal involvement in the process, and they said that the participation in the meeting was not necessary.
I'm curious, in all of your reporting on the Boring Company over the last year or so, you know, have you ever gotten a response to a request from an interview from the Boring Company?
I have not. I know that other reporters have and have done tours, but they're notable in their fact that they don't talk to the press very often, and they don't. They've kind of been a little bit of like a black box in some ways, is what some lawmakers have been alluded to. It's hard to get a clear answer on stuff.
You know, as I mentioned at the top, the city of Las Vegas just issued the first permit for construction of a tunnel. Are local officials in Clark County, Las Vegas, are they concerned about these complaints, or are they gung-ho for the Boring Company's mission to create new transportation alternatives?
Well, I have spoken to, for example, County Commissioner Jim Gibson, who's very gung-ho and very excited about this project. I haven't seen anyone else speak out negatively about Boring. I think I emailed with the county, and representatives from the county said, we've done all that we can in terms of safety, and we have full kind of oversight, and we're, in full control of the process and stuff like that. So I think the county, at least on the permit level, is not admitting or not saying that there's any wrongdoing. And then I think officials have been, some of them have been quite gung-ho, like the mayor as well.
Una Milken is a reporter covering, excuse me, Una Milliken is a reporter covering the Boring Company for the Nevada Independent. Una, thanks for the time.
Thank you, guys.
As of note, KNPR did reach out to the Boring Company, but did not receive a response. Someone who has also reached out to the Boring Company is Democratic Assembly Member Howard Watts. He's the chair of the Assembly Committee on Growth and Infrastructure. I spoke to him earlier this week about his concerns. Assembly Member Watts, thank you for joining me.
Yeah, glad to be here.
When did you first hear about these safety and environmental complaints, and when did you start growing concerned?
As you noted, I mean, there has been some reporting on these problems going back for years. And so I had not seen all of the news stories, but I had seen some. And I assumed that, while these were problems, that they would get addressed and they'd be fixed and things would move on. I think it was really last year and towards the end of the year that there were two stories that came out in close proximity to each other that really kind of sent the alarm bells off that this is a problem that has not been addressed. And in fact, it seems like it's getting worse. I think the last straw was finding out that there was this green pond of water at a Boring Company site that had appeared and was later filled in without any testing or answers to ensure that that wasn't being polluted by the company's operations. So that made it really clear to me that these were not one-off issues or mishaps, but it became clear as I started digging into it more that this was a pattern of bad behavior by this company.
Were you at all surprised that the company refused to take part in the hearing?
I was definitely disappointed by the Boring Company refusing to show up. They have they've offered some tours, they have spoken to some media outlets, and have generally downplayed what's gone on. And if there's no issue, then I don't know why they would want to hide. They should come to our committee and answer these questions and address some of the concerns that have been brought up and give us the information that we need to feel secure that as they look at continuing to dig in Las Vegas, as they have proposed digging tunnels between Reno and Trick, that they're going to do so responsibly. Unfortunately, all of the information that we've found up to this point is that they have not done so. They could have gotten free assistance from our state agencies to develop better worker safety and environmental protection practices. Instead, when they basically wait until they get fined, and then they fight the fines for as long as they can. And, despite having 17 OSHA violations for putting workers at risk, they've paid not a single cent in OSHA violations by dragging their feet and contesting the fines that they do get. So those are some of the issues that we wanted to get out there and on the record. And one of the reasons that it's taken so long is because a state health and safety review board that's appointed by the governor currently has two vacancies on it. So we would have liked to hear the governor's plan to ensure that that body can do its job in protecting workers in our state. But unfortunately, the governor's office also declined to attend our meeting.
The committee did receive a letter from the Boring Company explaining some of the steps it has taken to mitigate safety and environmental accidents. Was that enough? What do you want to hear from the Boring Company?
So, I think the questions that we focused on asking our regulatory agencies who did come to the meeting were focused on what has happened, what are the penalties that you can levy, what are some of the limitations that you're running into, and what are some of the things that we can do to help with that? And I think We did get some ideas and suggestions. I think we as the legislature are going to have to do even more to see what we can do, particularly to go after repeat offenders and companies that just refuse to clean up their act. I think my question for the governor's office has been one, why does the governor's office pick and choose when they want to get involved on behalf of a business? It seems like only large companies like Boring can reach out to the governor's office and get meetings scheduled to talk about penalties that they're facing. Fundamentally, with Boring drilling under our city right now, the question I want to know is, what is their plan to clean up their act? They have a lot of big plans to continue to grow their footprint both here in Nevada and across the country. And I am very uncomfortable with letting them do that until we know that they are no longer going to be putting workers at risk of injury repeatedly, and that they are no longer going to be illegally dumping chemicals into our groundwater, our storm drains, and our sewer system.
Assemblymember Howard Watts, thank you so much.
All right. Thanks, Paul.
That was Democratic State Assemblymember Howard Watts of Las Vegas speaking to me about the recent hearing lawmakers had about their concerns over the Boring Company's safety and environmental record. Once again, as I note, KNPR did reach out to the Boring Company, but did not get a response. When Congress decided not to extend the Affordable Care Act's enhanced subsidies late last year, consumer advocates hoped that the program that helped many Americans buy health insurance would be restored by early 2026. That, so far, hasn't been the case. The last bill aimed at resurrecting those subsidies died in the U.S. Senate late last month. As a result, health insurance premiums for over 85,000 Nevadans who shop on the state's Affordable Care Act marketplace have increased. Now, a month after the end of open enrollment, Nevadans are paying their first premium bills of the year. For many, the cost has gone up substantially, about 26% on average. For some, it's even more than that. So, what does this year's final open enrollment data tell us about how Nevadans are dealing with the end of the ACA tax credits? And how does Nevada's brand new state-run public option, the so-called battle-borne state plans, compare to private insurers? To find out, KNPR producer Ann Davis spoke to Katie Charlson, the communications director for Nevada HealthLink, the state's ACA marketplace.
Katie, welcome to State of Nevada.
Ann, thank you for having me. Happy to be here today.
Of course. So how did the experience this year change for consumers? Was it easier for them to navigate the marketplace, harder with all of the changes going on? Kind of what did you hear back from people?
Yeah, so this year, I mean, as we know, there was a lot of changes, which there was actually some positive to it. It really brought like the marketplace to light for a lot of Nevadans that they didn't realize that it was an option before. And we actually saw that our active enrollment, so people actually going in, shopping, selecting a plan, was up by 32%.
What do you attribute that increase in active enrollment to?
I think it's really the expiration of enhanced subsidies was probably the biggest thing, just because it was constantly in the news, people were unsure. So I think that people really wanted to make sure that they were getting a plan that best fit their needs. And we had new plans this year. This is the first year that we had the battle-borne state plans. So we talked a lot about those. I think people were curious. And they also, maybe people may have seen like a hike in their existing premium and they went back in and were able to find a plan for a better price.
Yeah, now you mentioned the battle-borne state plans. I do want to get to those in just a minute. But on the side of the ACA tax credits and the loss of those, how many people who rely on the marketplace actually lost those tax credits? Is this a sizable amount of people?
So the enhanced subsidies expired, but we still have subsidies available. So we don't have an exact number of how many people no longer qualify for subsidies. We're still kind of evaluating that data, but we still saw really good enrollment numbers this year. And 8 out of 10 enrollees are still qualifying for subsidies. So this year we ended at about over 104,000 Nevadans enrolled in health coverage, and last year was around 110,000. So we did see some decrease, but it really wasn't as big as we feared.
Okay. And so the give or take 6,000 people who didn't enroll this year, do you know what happened to those people? Were those people that just kind of dropped off of insurance, or kind of what happened to them?
Yeah, so there's always a really big range. We actually did a leaver survey this year, so hopefully we'll have some more data on that in the coming weeks. But a lot of it can be they got a job that they have insurance through now, they're on their spouse's insurance, they went to the individual market, they're no longer on the marketplace. There could be a lot of reasons that people come off the exchange. They could be eligible for Medicaid now. So it really just depends, and everyone's situation is different. And it could be because of cost or their premium went up and they decided they couldn't afford it. It's a hard decision to make, insurance is expensive. Everything is really expensive right now. But just really talking about the importance of it, I feel like a lot of Nevadans really saw how important it was to really budget for that and to include it in their spending, which was really great to see.
Okay. Now, switching gears to the Battle Born State plans, how popular were these? I understand it was their first year that consumers could actually sign up for them. Did a lot of people do that?
Yeah, so this year we had about 10% of our enrollees enroll in a Battle Born State plan. So that was 10,762 people. So it was really great numbers for being out the first time this year. And all of those enrollments were like active enrollments. So people actually went in there, selected a Battle Born State plan, and enrolled in it, which is really cool to see because there was no auto enrollments because these didn't exist last year. So there was a lot of like interest, and they're going to get better year after year is the goal, which I'm really excited about. The only difference between a Battle Born State plan and another plan on the marketplace is they're required to meet premium reduction targets. So those will come down again this year and hopefully save Nevadans even more money.
Okay, now about those premium reductions, how much lower are the premiums on these public option plans compared to just a typical, Affordable Care Act plan?
Yeah, so it ranges. There is still some like normal qualified health plans, but traditional qualified health plans that are less than a Battle Born State plan. It depends on where in the state it is. The Battle Born State plan was the lowest, it's called the second lowest cost silver in a couple of our service areas, including Clark County and Washoe. So that was the best option for many Nevadans in those areas. Not really apples to apples, but their goal was 3% in the first year. And sure, I believe it's 2 or 3% cut in the coming year.
Okay. Now, typically in December, Nevada HealthLink releases enrollment data from November, which is the first month of the open enrollment period. That didn't happen this year. Why did the marketplace hold off on releasing those enrollment numbers until later on in the period?
Yeah, with the subsidies expiring, we're really unsure of what it was going to look like. So just so that we didn't want to put out inaccurate numbers because really the numbers held really steady all year. There was no big drops or gains. It was pretty steady throughout the open enrollment period. But our fear was that, in December or in January, people were going to, see their premium and cancel their coverage, and we're going to see this big drop, and we'd be almost like reassuring, like, oh, nothing's happening right now. And then this big drop happens. So I think it was just more of the unknown. We were unsure what it was going to look like, and we didn't want to report on inaccurate numbers. But really, it stayed very steady the entire open enrollment. We saw, like I said, active shopping was way up. We were still getting new enrollments. It's been very steady the entire period.
Katie Charleston is the Communications Director for Nevada HealthLink. Katie, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
I now want to turn to someone with a personal experience from the consumer side. Jerry Misko is a prolific local artist who's already experienced increased premiums firsthand this year. Jerry, welcome back to State of Nevada.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So your premium has gone up by 111% this year. Tell me a little bit about the moment you first learned it was going to increase by that much. What was sort of your first reaction?
Well, aggravation, of course.
Yeah.
Like, okay, well, but also a little, honestly, a little bit of relief because at the time, I got the email from the company that stated, these are your new rates starting January 1. I had heard horror stories on, seen it on Facebook, on the news. People's rates were doubling, tripling, quadrupling, even, five, massive, massive increases for people. And mine only doubled plus a little bit. So while crummy, I didn't get it as bad as some people. That's but still, it was a big hit. But doubling is a big hit for any freelancer.
So a 111% increase is four times more than what Nevada Health Link predicted increases would look like this year, mm-hmm. which was around 26% on average. Do you know why yours went up so much? Were you given any sort of explanation by your broker or your agent?
No, that's just what it was. I mean, there were other options. If I wanted to keep the coverage that I had at the Equitable every year, you know, you have to pick a new plan, go through. If you want to keep what you have, there's always, okay, well, you have what you have, but it's a little bit different this year. Move on. You know, you pick that new plan. Like the year before, I think it went up $5-$10, something like that. But the coverage stayed basically the same. You know, not getting into details of things, but basically the same. So I could have had less expensive insurance this year or kept it a little bit less of a hit, but not too much. You know, it would have been like an 80% increase, but it would have been through some company I've never heard of with way less coverage, higher deductibles, that kind of thing. So I was like, no, I'll take the hit and keep my coverage. You know, I have a 4-year-old little girl now. I'm in my 50s. So I got, you know, my son's grown, but I want to be around. I want to see them.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Taking care of myself. And, you know, we discussed before the show, I spent my 20s and most of my 30s without health insurance, you know, doing the artist thing. But I need that coverage to make sure that I'm going to be around for my kids.
It didn't really cross your mind to just drop insurance entirely?
No, not at this point in my life. 15 years ago, absolutely. I would have been like, nah, man, I'm not dealing with this. Yeah. 20 years ago, wouldn't even been a thought. It would have been, yeah, you guys can keep it.
So what did your monthly premium used to be and what is it now?
It was $120 last year, mm-hmm. and it bumped up to $254.
Now, have you had to make sacrifices in other areas to be able to afford this or not?
You know,
so
like
much?
I said, we got to make what we make to get by, you know, so just make more work, do more things with the projects. And so not a specific sacrifice to keep the health insurance, but overall doing what I've done as an artist for a living has been a sacrifice in a lot of ways, but the rewards are worth it. You know, I sacrifice stability, a steady paycheck, those kind of things. But the rewards are I get to make art for a living. I get to do what I love. I wake up every day getting to be me and not the, you know, pawn of someone else. And that makes me happy. So it's just, again, cost of business.
Have you been offered or have you looked into any recourse or assistance to help lower these premiums at some point?
I have not. It's just been, this is what it is. You know, and I want to keep the insurance that I have. It's somewhere between, you know, the gold standard and catastrophic. You know, it's right in the middle there where my premiums are what they are now. My, you know, going to the doctor doesn't cost too much. Go drop a $50 copay or whatever it is. So those didn't go up, which is nice. And my monthly and yearly minimums, maxes, those kind of things didn't change much. Just the premium, that kind of thing. So,
yeah. If nothing changes sort of otherwise, what worries you most about the next few years in terms of insurance prices and insurance premium increases?
Just keeping, you know, just keeps going up and up and up. And, you know, between the car payment for the car, the insurance for the car, the health, if that just keeps going up and up, on top of just healthcare in general, prices are crazy. You know, you just want to go do the things you need to do to take care of yourself. Makes it prohibitive for a lot of people, and that doesn't seem like a very good plan for society in general.
Jerry Misko is a prolific local artist. Jerry, thank you so much for sharing your story.
Oh, my pleasure.
Turning now to April Corbin-Gurness, the deputy editor of the Nevada Current and someone who has continuously covered this year's open enrollment. April, welcome back to State of Nevada.
Thanks for having me.
Of course. So you compared a couple of other states' exchanges and enrollment numbers to Nevada's. What did you find through the course of your reporting that sort of struck you as interesting? Are other states also sort of grappling with lower enrollment numbers?
Yeah, I mean, throughout the open enrollment period, healthcare advocates were concerned that there were going to be steep drops across the country. And while the numbers are not finalized yet, it looks like there's only 9 states across the country that have seen increases in enrollment. And then the other 41 states have all seen declines in enrollment. Nationally, it was about a 5% decline, and Nevada was a little bit above that. So it was like 5.2% according to the most recent numbers that have been released. So a little bit higher than average, but really in the middle. And to compare that, states like North Carolina and Ohio saw drops of like 20% and above.
Oh,
so
wow.
Huge drops. There were a lot of states, at least a dozen, that had them in the double digits, 10% and above. So it was, you know, steep drops across the country. So we were spared sort of the worst of it.
Okay. Like. Yeah, that's what it sounds like. So are other states in a better position to potentially deal with these subsidy rollbacks through their own subsidy programs compared to Nevada?
Yeah. So Texas is actually one of the states that saw its enrollment increase this year. And that was primarily attributed to a statewide subsidy that they introduced this year. So they saw most of the overall nationwide increase is actually attributed to Texas. It was like 200,000 extra people had signed up in that state alone. And that was because the state legislature had done something specifically for them. Here in Nevada, obviously, we're not in session. We weren't in session, when the bulk of this was happening, conversation-wise. There was no action sort of on that front, but our state public option plan is attributed to keeping that number lower than it could have been. A state health official said that the introduction of these public option plans actually reduced all of the plans overall by about 4.6% compared to what they would be. They all still raised, to make that clear. All of the plans, the prices are higher overall, but they're not as high as they could have been, which could have helped keep us down further than it could have been.
Yeah. Now, those battle-borne state plans, like you just mentioned, were pretty popular with consumers this year. But there is organized opposition to these plans. Tell me a little bit about the legal battle that you reported on that's currently playing out here.
Yeah. So the Senate Minority Leader Robin Titus and a national group sued over the implementation of the battleborn state plans. They had hoped that the Nevada Supreme Court would rule on it before the plans went into effect. Obviously, that has come and gone, and they are sort of in progress now, which I think makes it a little harder to roll back. But we are still waiting for that ruling from the Supreme Court to see whether or not it may upend that. They have, after I asked them about whether or not their position had changed given the popularity of it, they sort of stood by and said the end result of open enrollment was that about 1 in 10 people chose a battle board state plan. So their counter to that was, well, 9 out of 10 didn't. So obviously these are terrible. So they're still opposed to that, even though we have seen them be popular with people.
Now, what is their sort of ground for opposition here? Do they just think these are sort of unconstitutional in terms of Nevada law?
Yeah, that's their legal argument. And I'm not a lawyer, but, they argue that it's unconstitutional, and we'll see what the court weighs in on that.
Realistically, what can happen over the next year beyond Congress reinstating the enhanced subsidies that might bring down premiums in Nevada? Is there anything that we could do on the state level to help here?
Nevada certainly could look at something like what Texas is doing, and I don't know the full details on what they're doing, but I do know that they've done stuff at the state level. So there are certainly other states that are doing things like that. They could certainly boost other sort of healthcare efforts that sort of fill in the gaps, things like, Medicaid and community health centers and programs and things that kind of fill in the gaps for people who maybe cannot afford an ACA plan and all of that. So there's certainly things that could be doing. I don't know if they can do anything directly, but also I'm also not a legislator, so I'm not sure. There could be options. It certainly is a key issue to a lot of state lawmakers. They understand the importance. They are hearing over and over again that people are struggling to pay those bills. So it's certainly going to be top of mind, I think, over the next year.
Yeah, absolutely. According to the Southern Nevada Health District, in 2024, just over 82% of Las Vegans reported having health insurance. Now, that stat placed the city among the worst 25% of cities in the nation for our rate of uninsured people. As Nevadans continue to struggle with affordability, there is a chance that our insurance rates continue to go down. But how dramatically do you expect this number to change, especially as, you know, people's first bills for their healthcare premiums are potentially, you know, coming in last month, coming in this month? How do you think it's going to maybe change?
Yeah, I mean, that's always been the concern with Nevada, is that pre-ACA, we had one of the highest uninsured rates in the country. So as any sort of healthcare provisions, any extended premiums or ACA expansion programs or anything like that, as those are rolled back or as attempts to roll those back happen, the concern is always that we are going to go back to that norm that existed before the ACA. So it's definitely a concern, especially with economic conditions. conditions and people being concerned about additional layoffs. We know that economic stress overall, if the options are paying for your healthcare premium or feeding your children and getting to work and paying for gas and your utilities, we know what people are going to choose in that situation. And we know that Nevada is sort of acutely sensitive to sort of economic shifts on that scale. And all of that's going to sort of trickle down into that healthcare system. So it's, you know, definitely something that is scary and the potential is there. We haven't seen that necessarily just yet. Obviously, our drop, our decline is less than it could have been. So that's good news, but it's obviously always something to watch.
Yeah, it's not static. Like you've said, it can change. April Corbin-Gurness is the deputy editor of the Nevada Current. April, thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Winning a national award like Library Journal's Librarian of the Year is a huge honor. And now we can say that honor has gone to one of Nevada's own. For 5 years, Kelvin Watson has led the Las Vegas Clark County Library District and its 25 branches as executive director. And in that time, he's established numerous programs and initiatives that have expanded services to all corners of Southern Nevada. He's been particularly instrumental in ramping up technological offerings in nearly every area of the district, as well as opening up the brand new West Las Vegas Library. KNPR's Mike Pravat spoke to Kelvin last week. Here's that conversation.
Kelvin Watson, welcome back and congratulations.
Thank you, Mike.
Librarian of the Year, that's a pretty big award, even considering all the other awards that you have garnered in your career. So I got to ask, how'd you feel when you heard the news?
I was excited. It's been going on for almost 40 years, and I'm the first African-American man to actually receive the award. So all the work, the culmination, all the years, that's what that award is for.
When you started with the Las Vegas Clark County Library District in early 2021, and by the way, this was when many of us weren't really going to libraries due to the pandemic, what were you seeing here and how did you begin to tackle it?
5 years ago, got here and Vegas was just reopening. We'll call it reopening. They just had started giving the COVID shots. And so for the library and having come here from Fort Lauderdale, the Broward County Libraries, it was really about just opening the doors and letting people back in. We were still doing drive-through service at that time where people would drive up and we put their books in the trunk, right? And, you know, the sanitizing of the libraries. And so really opening the space back up and making it available. The theaters, for example, the art galleries, just people being congregating together. So that was just one of the things that was on my plate. We did it right away, hit the ground running, and really leveraging what we learned from COVID, like QR codes and things like that.
You know, I was going to say, I imagine this is where your experience and expertise with technology came in very handy, given how much we were doing virtually and digitally before you started opening all that stuff back up.
Right. So one of the first projects that we launched was with the RTC, providing digital access on the buses with leveraging QR codes to our ebook collection. We launched that in the fall of 2021. Mm-hmm. So right away, yes, leveraging technology, you know, the mobile hotspots that we lend out to, you know, families and, you know, students. When I moved here, I didn't have my cable or internet set up. So I had a hotspot that, you know, did my whole home. So doing those things and really communicating to the public that these services are available to them via their library card was definitely one of the things that we were pushing.
Now, I got to ask, you know, technology is obviously not cheap. And I'm wondering, you know, in your new role, how were you finding funding or able to work the budget in a state where revenue for programs and education is, to put it one way, not exactly unlimited?
Right. So we were lucky, like all other libraries and educational institutions at that time, that the federal government was providing a tremendous amount of funding, the ARPA funds, that were really about bridging the digital divide, providing technology. And so that support helped us launch a lot of those programs, and we've been able to sustain a lot of them. But For example, our cell phone lending program that we launched soon thereafter at, you know, in 2022, that was all state ARPA funds that we had received.
Now, the award also notes your work in establishing partnerships with, you know, public-private sectors. This is to bolster, you know, the district and its programs. I suspect it involved a lot of networking, but I will ask, how did you go about creating this additional support?
It was really about getting the word out. The partnership that we had with Cox Communications, for example, to provide their internet service wherever Cox was available, was just through partnerships and conversations, right? Really being visible at a time when being visible was just starting to happen again. Mm. So I decided that I was going to show up and be in places, introducing myself. One of my library managers said this the other day. He said, I feel like we're a sports team. Like, the library is that popular. People love the library, not just our newest ones. They love all of our buildings, our reading programs that we offer during the Winter Challenge for students. We had a 34% increase in that program just this past January. So there's things like that.
So you ended 2025 with a bang. The new West Las Vegas Library opened in the historic West Side. This doubled the space of the one that had opened in 1989. What role did you see this new library serving the community?
5 years ago, when I was interviewing for the role, I visited two libraries in particular, being the West Las Vegas Library and the East Las Vegas Library. The East Las Vegas Library had just opened in 2019, so it was the newest library. With COVID, wasn't getting the utilization, but it was a, you know, it's a beautiful library, the East Las Vegas Library. Comparing that to the West Las Vegas Library that had been built in 1989, you know and could see the distinct differences. There was hardly any parking, for example. There were only 12 computers. The new library, the West Las Vegas Library, is an enhancement of the East Las Vegas Library. So yes, we do have some additional things that East Vegas doesn't have, like the editing room. We have an entirely different maker space. We also have specific green screen rooms in the new library. The other difference is that the new library has a dedicated business area. So we have a business librarian that we hired. We also have business offices like WeWork, mm-hmm. that the community can also, we'll call it rent, but use your library card to leverage that space.
The West Las Vegas Library, of course, will be a focal point for the events of Black History Month currently happening through February 28th. Several other branches will be hosting events and programming as well. How do you go about balancing the celebration and the educational components that are inherent with the holiday?
A lot of this is done, we'll call it, locally in that community library. So the branch manager and the programming team that are in those branches, they're the ones who are deciding specifically what programming, what educational assets they want to provide, because they actually know their communities much better than I do.
And what are some of the events planned that you're particularly excited about?
We've got events coming up exploring the origins of Black History Month, mm-hmm. February 18th at the Whitney Library. Black History Month, local, national, and international. I am a collector of quilts, so they've got a quilting event February 25th at Spring Valley Library. And the West Las Vegas Library is going to be, you know, having an art gallery exhibit through March the 1st.
Now, speaking of community outreach and accessibility, something I have seen over the past few years in the library's calendar is returning, and that is free tax preparation assistance during tax season. This is happening at, in my count, 8 branches. How did you make this come together, and what's available for people who are looking for help?
So we offer, through partnerships, the tax assistance. So we would have different firms, different organizations like the NAACP, for example, who are actually offering the actual tax assistance. We're just, the library being just a conduit, the space to make that happen. Mm.
Are there any qualifications for people to get the assistance?
Different organizations all have different services. Primarily, they focus, I know a lot of them do focus on the senior population.
Kelvin, you've had a strong start to 2026. What else do you want to accomplish for the district this year? Anything that we can look forward to?
I want to really solidify some of those partnerships that I mentioned. The Speedway, for example, really bridging the gap in what they are trying to achieve and what we're trying to achieve. They want the community to really be more involved. They want to work with the library to help make that happen. Summer Challenge, and we're looking to blow that out. Star Labs was the new project that we're going to be launching, so I'm looking forward to that. So we're going to be increasing the number of barbershops that have libraries in them. 2026 is started, but when I start, I'm typically already looking at 2027.
Kelvin Watson is the executive director of the Las Vegas Clark County Library District, and you can find out more details on the district's events and programs at kmpr.org. Kelvin, thank you so much.
Thanks, Mike.
There's no shortage of what to see, hear, and do at any time in Nevada. Back to talk about a few of the best options is KNPR senior producer Mike Pravat, who oversees the arts and culture beat for Nevada Public Radio. Hi, Mike.
Hey, Paul.
We just heard from Kelvin Watson from the Library District for some of its events commemorating Black History Month, but apparently that only scratches the surface.
There is a lot to do in Las Vegas related to Black History Month. This week in particular, I guess if you wanted something that offers a wealth of things to do in one place, especially if you wanted the whole family to take part, I would recommend the Black History Month Festival at Springs Preserve. Now, it's Springs Preserve, so there's going to be a lot of activities there that are based on learning. There's also going to be arts and crafts, but then they're also adding games for kids, and you can get food there. There's cultural goods for sale. Probably a very big draw for this festival would be that there are musical performers and dance ensembles performing on that outdoor, big outdoor stage area. That is all included with the price of admission to Springs Preserve. You just got to remember to make the reservation online. That is going to be held Saturday, February 14th. Now, for my second recommendation for Black History Month, Paul, I do believe you have spent some time living in the South. Are you familiar with the Blind Boys of Alabama?
Yeah, my first job in public radio was in Alabama. I assure you, the Blind Boys were a staple.
So for those of you who don't know, the Blind Boys are a very acclaimed Black gospel group that dates back to 1939, which means they've had many members over the years to keep it going. And the name comes from the fact that many of those members, previous and current, were or are vision impaired. Now, talent impaired, they are not. They've played for countless acts and music festivals. They've won 6 Grammys, been nominated 15 times. They once did the theme music for that HBO show, The Wire, that was on many years ago. And this is, by my research, only the 4th time that they've ever been in Vegas in nearly 30 years. So this means you should catch them at the Smith Center on February 12th.
Sounds like that could be a good time, but not necessarily what I call romantic. What about Valentine's Day? That's this weekend.
Well, this is an interesting concept that's part tribute concert and part stage biography. Vegas performer and musician Anthony Brady is assuming the role of the jazz great Louis Armstrong for a performance. It's a musical theater show called Satchmo Sings for Women, and it tells the story of how Armstrong's music evolved with, or perhaps because of, each of his 4 marriages. Appropriate for Valentine's Day, right? Brady will be assisted by 7 other local performers acting and singing throughout the musical. And this comes to us from the city of Las Vegas. This is to say that it's free and it's at the West Las Vegas Theater.
Louis Armstrong, always a solid pick for a Valentine's Day playlist. Speaking of date ideas, I hear you have some damn fine movie recommendations for this weekend.
The pun never stops with the Damn Short Film Festival. So from today, February 11th through Monday, February 16th, downtown Boulder City will host the 22nd edition of the Southern Nevada Film Institution. I think this is one of the longest film festivals in the state. And it's never a bad time to initiate yourself if you've never been. This year, there are more than 150 short works that are being featured in 32 different viewing packages. I'd say each of them run about maybe an hour, hour and a half. And it does not miss a genre, whether it's sci-fi, animation, comedy. For horror fans, that program takes place on Friday the 13th. And I think there's a romantic one for Valentine's Day. There's programs for underground and avant-garde works as well. And the participating filmmakers represent countries from all over the world.
What about local filmmakers? Is this something they or even aspiring local filmmakers can get in on?
There are multiple programs showcasing Nevada-based work, and I can't think of a better, easier way to take in a great sample of Silver State movie talent than viewing one or more of these programs. Plus, the festival also features networking and in-person events so you can meet film industry professionals. And to that point, the whole area, that whole downtown Boulder City area, has a lot of great energy during the event. Everyone's kind of milling about between the bars and the eateries. There's a lot of socialization going on. It kind of makes for a little scene for a festival full of little movies. And that's at the Elaine K. Smith Building in Boulder City.
Sounds like it might have a little more to offer than the two-hour-plus Oscar bait in the theaters. At least that's for me. Anyways, your last recommendation is another movie.
And some live music, I will explain. On February 13th, The Beverly is treating us to both a live soundtrack performance and a showing of the oldest existing feature-length animated film. And no, Disney loyalists, it's not Snow White. This is the 100th anniversary of The Adventures of Prince Ahmed. This is a film entirely made of silhouette animation that uses lighting and cardboard cutout characters and scenery to tell the story of the prince. And while the movie plays, so will New York-based band Morricone Youth, and they'll be playing in the flesh.
As in Ennio Morricone, didn't we just talk about him?
Yeah, on this very segment last week. So it's fitting that Morricone Youth is well known for recreating film soundtracks. I think they've done more than 100 of these in the course of their like 27-year career. So you can watch a pioneering century-old movie and this very innovative band who I believe will liven up the usual movie watching experience.
Sounds like it all could be fun. That's all the time we have for this week. Thanks, Mike.
Thank you, Paul.